Welcome to Life in Debt, your practical debt education program. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak. I'm speaking from CRU LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, an award-winning, listener-supported, open-source grassroots community radio station broadcasting from the Cultural District in Fairfield. Please note that these presentations are provided as a public service for general information purposes only and are not intended to be legal opinions, legal advice, or complete discussions of any legal issues. Remember, every individual's factual situation is different, and you should seek independent legal advice from an attorney familiar with the laws of your state or locality regarding specific information. The name of this show is Life in Debt, and it is a weekly half-hour educational show looking at all types of issues related to debt as it influences your life. This show provides practical, general knowledge about what to look for regarding debt, what are its traps and pitfalls, and what to do to be an educated debtor. Please get notebook, paper, and pen to take notes during the show. First, as we do each week, we look at some debt-related news and facts for the week. I'd like to start with a few highlights on how the CEOs did for the companies that got bailed out or fell apart of late. Merrill Lynch, Stan O'Neill was the CEO from 2003 to 2007. His severance package was $162 million. Chuck Prince was the CEO for Citigroup from 2003 to 2007. His severance package was $110 million. The founder and CEO of Countrywide, Angelo Mazzillo, had sold stocks and options in 2006 before the great failure of the company. He received $130 million. Jimmy Kane, CEO from 1993 to 2008 for Bear Stearns, sold stock right before the crash for $61 million. The CEO for Morgan Stanley, Philip Purcell, was the CEO from 1997 to 2005. His severance package was $94 million. Franklin Raines was the CEO of Fannie Mae from 1999 to 2004. His compensation during those years was $90 million. Daniel Mudd is currently the CEO for Fannie Mae. His compensation from 2004 to 2008 is $43 million. Freddie Mac, on the other side, Richard Syron, was the CEO from 2003 to 2007. His 2007 compensation was $19.8 million. Martin J. Sullivan is the CEO for AIG from 2005 to 2008. His severance package was $47 million. Maurice R. Greenberg, CEO for AIG from 1968 to 2005. They estimate that he's worth billions of dollars. Richard Severin Flood Jr., the CEO from 1994 to 2008 for Lehman Brothers, had received compensation of $500 million. And last but not least, Ken Lewis, the CEO of Bank of America from 2001 to present, has received compensation of $213 million for his work. So even though these companies have had huge problems, their CEOs were not the biggest losers in the process or in the demise. On the other side of the coin, from an article by Heather Burke out of Bloomberg, holiday sales dropped to force bankruptcies and closings. U.S. retailers face a wave of store closings, bankruptcies, and takeovers starting next month, as holiday sales are shaping up to be the worst in 40 years. Retailers may close 73,000 stores in the first half of 2009, according to the International Council of Shopping Centers. Talbots Inc. and Sears Holdings Corp. are among chains shuttering underperforming locations. More than a dozen retailers, including Circuit City Stores Inc., Linens and Things Inc., Sharper Image Corp., and Steve and Barry's LLC, have sought bankruptcy protection this year as the credit squeeze and recessions drained sales. Investors will start seeing a wide variety of chains seeking bankruptcy protection in February when they file financial reports, said Bert Flickinger. You'll see department stores, specialty stores, discount stores, grocery stores, drug stores, major chains, either multi-regionally or nationally, go out, Flickinger, managing director of Strategic Resource Group, a retail industry consulting firm in New York, said last week in a Bloomberg radio interview. There are a number that are real causes for concern. Sales at stores open at least a year probably dropped as much as 2% in November and December, the ICSC said last week, more than the previously projected 1% decline. That would be the largest drop since at least 1969, when the New York-based trade group started tracking data. Gap Inc. and Macy's Inc. are among retailers that will report December results on January 8th. Some good news for consumer creditors, however, is that federal regulators last week adopted sweeping new rules for the credit card industry that will shield consumers from increases in interest rates on existing account balances, among other changes. The bad news is that the rules don't take place until July 2010, but they will allow credit card companies to raise interest rates only on new credit cards and future purchases or advances rather than on current balances. Those rules were approved by the Office of Thrift Supervision, a Treasury Department division. The Federal Reserve and the National Credit Union Administration will expect to act on them later. The changes mark the most sweeping clampdown on the credit card industry in decades and are aimed at protecting consumers from arbitrary hikes in interest rates or inadequate time provided to pay the bills. John Reich, the thrift agency's director, said the rules will enhance public confidence in financial institutions and establish a level playing field for institutions that want to do business fairly without suffering competitive disadvantages. Most of the rules were first proposed in May 2008 and drew more than 65,000 public comments, the highest number ever received by the Fed. They also restrict such lender practices as allocating all payments to balances with lower interest rates when a borrower has balances with different rates. In addition, consumers will have to be given 45 days notice before any changes are made to the terms of an account, including slapping on a higher penalty rate for missing payments or paying bills late. Under current rules, companies in most cases give 15 days notice before making certain changes to the terms of an account. Roughly 16,000 companies in the United States issue credit cards. The biggest lenders include Discover Financial Services, LLC, Bank of America Corp., Citigroup, Inc., J.P. Morgan Chase & Company, Capital One Financial Corp., American Express Company, and HSBC Holdings. The head of the American Bankers Association called the changes, quote, strong new regulations that are unprecedented in their scope and signal the beginning of a new market structure for credit cards. Travis Plunkett, legislative director of Consumer Federation of America, said consumer frustrations run deep, as reflected in the comment letters submitted to the Fed. Many of them were spontaneous from consumers who feel they've been treated unfairly by credit card companies and are literally begging the Fed for help. In those complaints, many people acknowledged paying late, often mistakenly, and felt it was unreasonable for their card issuer to increase the interest rate on the balance. Another common theme came from people who pay on time but are hit with a rate increase because the company needed to recoup losses from other card holders. Under the new rules, credit card lenders will be required to apply any payment above the minimum to the part of the balance with the highest interest rate. The so-called subprime cards for people with low credit scores typically have no more than a $500 credit limit, but require a large upfront fee. The rules cap that fee at 50% of the credit limit and allow the cardholder to pay off the initial balance over a year, not immediately. The Consumer Federation estimates that credit card debt held by U.S. consumers is about $850 billion, some four times what it was in 1990. So these rules will be very beneficial. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. As always, in the second segment of the show, we will be reviewing what I discussed last week and want to give the important credit to the thoughts, ideas, examples used in these programs, which are directly from or based on the work, theories, and books of Professor Elizabeth Warren from Harvard and her daughter Emilian Warren Tyagi, two of America's leading champions for debtors. I highly recommend their books, All Your Worth and The Two Income Trap. You can also review prior shows, every show in the archives at www.kruufm.com. Life and Debt Archives, so you can hear all of the programs that I have done. I've been talking about stocks as investments for the last couple of weeks for people's savings. The main point really was, once we've gotten through the other issues regarding our debt, and savings was something that was a legitimate reality for us, that 20% of our disposable monthly income can now be allocated to the last stage of savings, where we are in our analysis, which essentially is your retirement fund, paying off your mortgage principal, the balance paying it down, and then saving money for your other dreams. That's how we're going to deal with the 20%. Now, that 20% at this level, we discussed taking your retirement money and also the additional money, so this is 5% of your disposable monthly income for your retirement fund, and then also 5% for your other dreams, and 10% to pay down your mortgage balance. Well, the two 5%, the retirement and your other dreams, now this is money that I suggested should go into indexed mutual funds stocks. And we discussed that a lot, and it's very diversified, and it gives a wide range of stability and protection, and things offset themselves. These are long-term investments, so regardless of how the stock market goes up and down, you're really safe. Over time, you will get 10 to 12% historically on this kind of investment, but it needs to be for at least 5, 10, 15 years or more. And with that as a backdrop, last week we discussed the concept of specifically thinking, well, I know of some company that I want to put my money into because they have something great, some great product, they're on the rise, their profits are showing a very, very rapid growth. And so why not take all of my money for retirement and for this other 5% for all of my dreams and put all that money into the stock of that one company? And I said that the problem is that if this is happening, there are a lot of people who are experts at noticing these kinds of products, and so literally thousands upon thousands of professionals who are investors and are spending all their waking hours looking at these kinds of profits, they are savvy, they know it's a good company, and they've already bid up the price of the stock, which means that you probably won't make any more money buying that stock than you would any other. So you're sacrificing your diversity and you're not really making any money. And as I said, that the top economists generally believe that even the smartest investors are likely to lose money when they try to pick individual stocks. So the primary concept, the definition, is diversification. You want to diversify, and the conservative index mutual funds are the best bet. And we put that same caution on the situation where even if it's your employer's stock, You still don't do this kind of single business investment because bad things can happen to your company even. People lose their jobs and their retirement accounts. We're seeing a lot of that right now in the news. You may have your retirement account with your employer. That's great. There's often matching funds that come in because of that, so that 5% can stay there. But the other excess money that you have as savings to invest, do not put it there. What you do is you put it in the indexed mutual fund. Also, there was the issue of the natural temptation, because we see it so much, it's such a prominent feature of our news and the sensationalism of the ultra rich, that people want to play the market. You may want to do this. There are many, many smart, savvy, highly educated professionals interested in this kind of investment activity. But I suggest you don't take it as a professional unless that actually is your job, that you may take it as a hobby, but you don't play the market with your retirement fund and all of the extra savings. It's just like a small amount of money that you would put aside to spend in an almost frivolous way, an expectedly non-financially productive way, but on the feeling level, as fun and as a hobby, that's fine. But don't put much of your resources into it. I also discussed last week that you may have a financial advisor and you need that help and want that help. And many people do get pulled into this kind of expert advice. And that's fine. You just need to be careful because stockbrokers are salespeople and they make their money off getting you something to buy. And oftentimes it's things you don't need to buy. The conservative retirement account, that's fine. But when they try to steer you towards some high-priced gizmo that yield the fattest commissions for them, they'll not generally be getting the best returns for you. So you have to be very careful with this. And they're very smart and they can come up with elaborate reasons why the high fee mutual fund is better than an index fund. But what you do is ask them what their commission is, and if you don't like what you're hearing, then your answer is to just leave and don't sign. Just as a quick recap, some investments specifically to avoid are forms of exotic currency investment that can be put into your overall indexed mutual fund package, but as an isolated kind of investment, do not do that. Prepaid funerals is putting money in a place where you could frankly lose it, so you wouldn't do these prepaid funerals. That's not the place to put your money. And then collectibles as a place for your savings. This is also not a place where you want to put your money, whether it's in coins or comic books or baseball cards or stamps or antique furniture, first edition books, artwork, classic cars. All these kinds of things are fine for a hobby activity, but not for savings. This is not your savings. You're not going to get rich generally with this. Some one isolated person periodically can do it, but it is not the way to deal with your 20% at all. Have fun with it, enjoy your hobbies, but it's not the cornerstone for your retirement. And the last thing I discussed last week was the 529 college savings plan for your child. This is really good when your kids are little. And the reason for it is that these 529 college plans are tax-free growth on your savings. So that's a very good place to put your money. You maintain control over the account. Even though the account's in your child's name, you decide when to distribute the money and how much is given out. You can actually take it back and use it for another purpose. There's some small penalty, but it does give you flexibility. And it's really easy to make these kinds of plans. Each state offers one, and you can sign up in any state, regardless of where you live or where your child ultimately goes to college. And the 529 plan, for most people, is not going to pay for the entire college, but it is going to be something very useful to offset the increasing cost for college degrees, and your child can still get scholarships and grant money and part-time jobs, but this is a great dent in the burden of cost for the college education, and it's a good place to put some of your savings money. If you are just tuning in, this is bankruptcy attorney Robert Liptak, and this program is Life and Debt, your practical debt education program. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond. Now we've basically looked at the entire concept of savings, and of course there's a psychology that's associated with savings, and you have the knowledge about it from the shows that I have recorded in the past and from Elizabeth Warren's books, if you went out and got those, which again, I highly recommend that you do that. And so you have the knowledge, you have the tools, and yet you can also have these negative thinking traps which can stop you from really balancing your money and your situation, create a kind of sabotage of your savings plan. Having a psychology degree and also having been an educator for so long, 16, 17 years, I know how much the mind can affect outcomes. Even if all of the facts and tools and data and knowledge are there, a person can think of something in a negative way, put a negative spin on it, and of course that is very destructive for that individual and is a great wall or blockage impediment for getting the result. So even in the savings area, you can say, well, I can't afford to save. But actually, if you've done this program and you've gone through with the formula, you can afford to save. You have balanced your bare necessities, your wants, and your savings from your disposable monthly income. You've implemented that, and so you have savings opportunities here. Even if you're in a stage where you're using your savings to pay off your unsecured debt, that's okay. It is there with the eventual breakthrough to it being cash in investments. And you may have some negative thought about, well, I'll really never save enough. And it's just like any other successful program in life that you go one step at a time, and wealth is built $1 at a time for most people. And that can be very substantial wealth, and you just need to take out the negative thinking about it. With this investment downside thinking, oh, it's so hard, I can't do it, I have to be an expert, or some greed or gluttony, I just will only do it if I'm making a huge amount of money in a short period of time. Gong. That's wrong. That's not what we're talking about here. We're talking about an index fund, and that's really all you need, and that can wipe out all of the negative thinking. Or you can think, well, I've had all these setbacks with my debt and my finances, and I'll never get caught up again. Well, as an attorney dealing with people constantly, I see that this is not anything more than a form of resignation. There are lots and lots of ways, as you've listened to in these shows, where people can turn their financial situation around. Setbacks do happen, but you can just reverse that and push forward on making a brighter future for yourself and your family and loved ones. You may think, well, if I put my money in the market went down and all my hard work is gone, but these are long-term investments we're talking about, and the market will go up again. I'm in it for the long term, for the long haul. I'm not selling. And as a result, you will regain any losses. You just don't get lost in this running intellectually, emotionally, day by day looking at the market. That's not what we're talking about here. Leave that to the people on Wall Street and focus on the simplicity that is being given to you here, which will work and will improve your life. And the final thing is negatively, you can keep on putting it off. You say, well, I can't do it this week, I can't do it this month, I can't do it this year. And the philosophy, the theory, and the experience is that we do it right here, right now, today. We don't take on any more debt, and we start saving. Which really leads to the very last thinking trap about saving. It really deserves an underline. That's the trap of telling yourself that you're just not ready, or that if you can't save 20%, there's no point in saving anything. It's almost like the Nike phrase, just do it. You start saving now. It takes action, not just intentions, and you have to do it. You have to put the program together. You have to put the formula together. If you need to read the book to review, if you need to go back and listen to these shows, I highly recommend that you do that. But at this point, we're talking about taking action on your savings. Take some dollars out of your paycheck and start saving. Even if you don't get it perfectly, even if you don't have the full 20%, or you don't have your retirement account set up right away, saving something is always better than saving nothing. Every dollar you save is a dollar toward a brighter future. On the other hand, if you have actually gotten through all of the knowledge and you have made it through all of the steps, and that includes now your 20% fourth stage savings as was outlined, you have really done something that is amazing. And if you haven't, I can bet that if you follow this program, eventually you will. And it really is a celebratory moment to have accomplished that, because you move past 63% of credit card carrying Americans who are lugging around a balance on their credit cards. You're not one of the 50% of the Americans who worry about their bills. And with this program, you're doing better than 48% of Americans who have not saved one single dollar for retirement. This is really taking care of yourself, your loved ones, and of course, the results of this kind of balance is less stress. Less stress means you're sleeping better, you can laugh louder, you have more security and comfort, less worry, you're living more enthusiastically, your relationships are improved. So you have reached a place that really is rare for most middle class and lower class Americans. And it is kind of freedom that is frankly spiritual in its own materialistic way. And that's because there is a balance, and there is responsibility, and there's happiness that comes all from this sort of result. In fact, next week we'll look a little bit at love and money and how the two interrelate. This is bankruptcy attorney Robert Luptak, and you have been listening to Life and Debt, your debt education program. If you have any questions or comments, call the station at 641-209-1083. Or you can email me at lifeanddebt@gmail.com. I'm speaking from Crew LP 100.1 FM, the voice of Fairfield, Iowa. May you enjoy and have a healthy and prosperous debt manageable life.